And Applebaum's new book, Iron Curtain, The Crushing of Eastern Europe, 1945 to 1956, has been called masterful, a groundbreaking investigation, a history shelf must, gripping, and another masterful account of the brutality of Soviet rule. At the end of World War II, the Soviet Union, to its surprise and delight, found itself in control of a huge swath of territory in Eastern Europe. Stalin and his secret police set out to convert a dozen radically different countries to communism, a completely new political and moral system. In The Iron Curtain, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Anne Applebaum describes how the communist regimes of Eastern Europe were created and what daily life was like once they were complete. Again, the name of the book is Iron Curtain, 1944 to 1956, The Crushing of Eastern Europe. Anne Applebaum, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
It is, I guess, when you look at what you have written and at your career, that at some point it was inevitable that you would tackle this subject.
Well, I don't know about inevitable. But yes, no, it's certainly a subject that was not an accident that I came to it, although in fact, I came to it in some ways through my previous book, which was a history of the Gulag system. And although this is not in any way a sequel to that book, it was while writing that book that I became interested in this question of why people went along with it. You know, why did people collaborate or cooperate or allow themselves to be moved by totalitarian regimes? And I, after thinking about how to write about that question, I came to the conclusion that this was the period in which I could write about that in the clearest way, because this is the period when totalitarianism is Soviet style totalitarianism is brought in from the outside and imposed on a series of very different countries in 1945.
When you look at the start of this book, as I mentioned, 1944, so give us a sense of what was happening at that time to give us a starting point for this story.
Right. Yes, 1944 is when the Red Army, having fought against the Wehrmacht, against the German army, begins to fight its way out of its own territory and into what we later came to call Eastern Europe. And it encounters for the first time non-Soviet societies, so countries which had not been previously under Soviet rule. Some of the first encounters take place in eastern Poland. The Red Army immediately runs into the Polish partisans, the Polish resistance movement, which was one of the largest resistance movements in Europe. And it encounters them. It's not sure what to do about them. The Home Army reveals itself to the Red Army, and in fact, the decision is taken. The Red Army meets them, disarms them, arrests them, and sends them east to labor camps. And in a way, this is the very significant first encounter with non-Soviet society, and it really proceeds from there. So, in 1944 and 1945, the Red Army, followed by and accompanied by the Soviet NKVD, which is what the KGB was called at that time, the political police or the secret police, fight their way through the region, and everywhere they go, they immediately begin to impose elements of their own society on the nations where they are liberating these countries in a very real sense from Nazi occupation, but they begin to impose a new system immediately.
You write in the book about the political parties, the church, the media, the organizations of young people, really any institution of civil society at every level, of how quickly they were eviscerated. And just in looking at the years of 45 to 55, 56, of just what was able to be accomplished in a relatively short period of time.
Yes, in a relatively short period of time, the Soviet Union did establish that if you are willing to use violence, and they used violence in a particular way, they used targeted violence. This was not a period when they were carrying out mass massacres, as they actually did in before the war and during the war. There's no equivalent of the Katyn massacre when they randomly massacre 20,000 Polish officers. There's no equivalent of that in this period. They use targeted violence. They have some idea in advance of the kinds of people that they want to eliminate and either physically eliminate, that is either arrest and execute or deport or otherwise quash, repress. And there are categories, former politicians, former policemen, leading intellectuals, leading leading cultural figures, leading businessmen. So in other words, leaders from all different parts of society are immediately subject to investigation, interrogation, and so on. So among other things, it's going for the leaders of society. At the same time, they make a kind of outreach to the people who they think are going to support them. And so a number of policies are done right away. There's a land reform carried out that's intended to win the peasantry over. Well, that backfires in various ways, but anyway, that's one thing they do. Another thing they do, which you as a radio host will appreciate, is they immediately, one of the things the communists do, as soon as they enter any new city or any new country, they take over the radio stations, and they make sure that the radio does not accidentally fall into anybody else's control. And this is because the radio is that time the most important mass medium, and they reckon it can reach the most people. And so, you know, the minute when the Red Army gets to Berlin, one of the first things it does is take over the radio station, protect it from further damage, and immediately staff it with German-speaking communists, German communists, some of whom have spent the war in Russia, and they bring them in to run the radio station immediately, and they get it back up on the air, I think only 2 weeks after Hitler's death, which was the last Nazi broadcast. So that tells you something about how important they thought it was. They immediately begin to try and reach people. And yes, for a brief period of time, you know, if you had visited these countries in 1950 or 1951, you would have thought they had succeeded. You would have imagined that they had wiped out all opposition and dissent of all kinds.
And when did that tide start to turn where you wouldn't have gotten that impression anymore?
Well, you wouldn't have, as an outsider, in the immediate aftermath of Stalin's death, there are already begin to be changes. And in the spring, in June of 1953, you already have the first serious set of, they're really political strikes take place in East Germany, in East Berlin. And there you begin to have people on the street protesting against the regime right away. What you might not have seen was that even in really the harshest period, in the period when terror is being used in the most direct way, and when propaganda is harshest in the late 40s, perhaps, and early 50s, you wouldn't have seen that people. The regime was very good at getting people to go along with things. You know, getting people. You know, people felt they had no choice. They had to march in the May Day parade. They had to sing the party songs. But then they might march in the May Day parade, and then they might go home in the evening and twiddle the dials of their radio station, try to get Radio Free Europe and find out what was happening somewhere else. So the system created many, many, many millions of reluctant collaborators, people who went along but weren't exactly sure they believed it, or were happy to say the slogans in public but told jokes in private. And so that in a way, the elements that would eventually undermine these regimes were there from the very beginning as well.
When you talk about that they had no choice, and really the choices were to fight, to flee, or to collaborate, and as you stated at the very beginning, one of the goals of the book was to look into why people went along with it. So when presented with those three choices, why was it to that feeling of they had no choice?
Well, you say you're going to fight, flee, or collaborate. Well, flee. The one group of people who could flee most easily were the Germans, because they could leave East Germany and they could go to West Germany. And for a while, that wasn't so difficult. Later on, it became very difficult. And, of course, after 1961, it became impossible after the wall was built. But for the Germans, it was not as hard a choice. You know, they left Germany and they went to Germany, and it was still their language and their culture. For Poles or for Hungarians or for Czechs, this was a really dramatic decision. You would leave behind your country, your language. They didn't necessarily speak other languages. Become a refugee, leave your family, leave your elderly parents, leave your sick mother-in-law. For many people, that was an impossible choice. They couldn't leave. Fighting. Well, to fight, there were people who fought. The Poles in particular fought. Actually, it's a slightly different story, but in the Baltic states, people fought as well. But fighting was a really hopeless and increasingly an unpleasant thing to do. You know, there were many people. The Polish resistance had been in the woods already for many years. They had been fighting the Germans. And after the war ended, they often found themselves isolated. You know, the bands of partisans remained in the forest. They stayed in hiding. They prepared to fight the Russians. But they didn't necessarily have the support of the peasantry anymore. People didn't want to give them food and help. they wound up stealing. Some people didn't like doing that. And at a certain point, when they realized that there was going to be no Western help, when, you know, the Western liberal democracies were not going to aid them, the United States and Britain were not going to declare World War III, they were going to be all by themselves in the woods fighting this enormous prospect of fighting the Red Army. And they gave up. You know, there were people, I should add, who decided to die courageously and heroically and pointlessly. There were many such people. But there were people who began to feel it's not worth it, and they left their comrades in the woods. They tried to rejoin society. There's an interview I did with a Polish writer who described to me what it was like to be 18 or 19 at the war's end, to walk out of the woods, to have no home, no family, no education, because he'd been fighting those previous years, to own nothing, to have no money, no possessions, and to be forced to start from scratch. I mean, it was a terrible thing to have to do. And then many people began to feel, what was the point of all that? Why did we do that? Why did we have to do that? And that was, in his case, that was it caused him to question why he'd fought at all. And he was briefly a member of the Communist Party. He was briefly a Stalinist writer. He wrote social realist fiction. Later he renounced it. But, this is a very dramatic time. People made dramatic decisions that I think we find hard to imagine. You know, we don't have to decide to abandon everything, leave our homes, leave everything, and knowing that we will never return in the way that people did at the time.
We may have trouble imagining it, but in reading the book, in the way you describe it, there is that tap on the shoulder of just the fragility of a free society, of how, again, relatively quickly it can all go away.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things the book does show is how easily, you know, ancient institutions, ancient universities, charities, social institutions that have been developed over many, many decades, you know, banks, companies, how they can be overrun, you know, if somebody is determined enough, if they use enough violence, if they know what they're doing and they've thought about it in advance. Yes, you can undermine institutions like that, and it is an illustration of how fragile things are and how, we shouldn't make assumptions that things that we think are going to last forever will last. You know, we need to always keep in mind the need to protect and defend the institutions of a free society.
The name of the book is Iron Curtain: The Crushing of Eastern Europe, 1944 to 1956. The book is published by Doubleday. Anne Applebaum, a great pleasure. I thank you very much for sharing this story with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, the name of the book, Iron Curtain: The Crushing of Eastern Europe, 1944 to 1956. The book is published by Doubleday. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.